From Phillipsburg to Hermitage, Port Allegheny to Harrisburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, once again, it is down to the wire with the Pennsylvania state budget, the deadline of June 30th rapidly approaching. David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And the U.S. economy nationwide is moving in the right direction. But will Pennsylvania's tax and regulatory climate cause us to be left behind? I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Congressional Republicans have been pushing to cut fraud in the Medicaid system. Democrats, however, oppose the effort, calling it a cut in benefits. However, a Philadelphia journalist has just pled guilty to taking part in a $12 million Medicaid fraud scheme. Angelo Amorosi, who writes under the pen name A.D. Amorosi, contributed articles to the Philadelphia Inquirer as well as other publications. The scheme involved fraudulent claims for medications and prescriptions that were never filled. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate is now considering President Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill that includes provisions to root out corruption in the Medicaid system. Pennsylvania's U.S. Senator John Fetterman has angered those on the left, which includes most of the Democratic Party, by taking sensible positions on issues such as Israel and immigration. He has come under increasing attack for failing to hew to the leftist line. Now his former chief of staff is forming yet another left-wing think tank, supposedly with the goal of pushing, quote, the most broadly popular positions, regardless of which wing of the party they come from, end quote. Sounds a bit like what Fetterman is doing, but his positions have not fared well with his party's extremist base. 2026 will be a gubernatorial election year in Pennsylvania. Governor Josh Shapiro is a shoo-in for the Democratic Party nomination, but the picture is less clear on the Republican side. State Treasurer Stacey Garrity and Congressman Dan Muser have been touring the state as they contemplate bids for that office. State Senator Doug Mastriano, who was the party's nominee in 2022, also has indicated an interest in a new bid. While in Pittsburgh for a rally celebrating the U.S. Steel-Nippon Steel deal, President Donald Trump said of Congressman Muser's potential bid, quote, if that's your decision, you've got my support, end quote. No candidate has officially announced, but with summer now underway, the time is at hand for candidates to make their decisions. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. What makes for a good state budget? Well, there are a lot of different answers to that question, and they're difficult to resolve with a divided state legislature. Our Capital Watch crew is here with their priorities for the state budget. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capital Watch All-Stars from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, President and CEO, Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, so good to see you.
Good to be here again, David. Thank you.
And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, thanks for being on the show.
Happy to be here, David. Looking forward to it.
Well, we are, you know, hip deep in the big muddy of the Pennsylvania state budget for 25-26, coming up on the deadline, the time when the new budget is supposed to be done, June 30, but you know, no one is expecting that is going to happen this time around because things are at loggerheads. Is that a fair way to put it, Steve?
Fair way to put it. And, you know, Pennsylvania is a state that is a purple state. It's got a divided state government. The Senate is controlled by a Republican majority. The House is controlled by a Democratic majority. Very thin, but Democrats control it. And there's a Democratic governor. So that's the arena we have to work with, which makes things hard in terms of finding solutions that all three parties can agree to.
Conflicting worldviews.
Conflicting worldviews. And so on the big picture, we're seeing that those are the adversaries as such squaring off over the budget. And why the budget is so particularly important in Pennsylvania, each state legislature runs things its own peculiar way. In Pennsylvania, much of the substantial legislation, the important things that happen, are in one way, shape, or another tied into the budget agreement that is ultimately negotiated between those parties I mentioned. So it's not just about the state budget. It's often about a lot of public policy of various kinds. And so it all boils down to this intense attempt to finish the budget by the constitutionally prescribed deadline of June 30th. We've seen that date slip many times, and the parties say, well, we just can't solve it now, but we're on track, and maybe we'll come back in August or November or December or next March, and we'll get it squared away. We've seen all sorts of variations. But it's always egg on the face of those who have the majorities and the control of things when it seems that they can't competently get a budget done. So there's some leverage there for the parties themselves to kind of force themselves to get this thing done in a reasonable amount of time so Pennsylvania can move forward.
Right. And of course, it's always more important that it be a good work product than that it be delivered by a certain day, because as you mentioned, Steve, the implications of the many, many choices that are expressed through that budget, reverberate, widely. And so I suppose, there are too many moving pieces right now to try to explain to the listeners exactly how things are working or are going to work out. But the one thing we could do is how should things go? If we had a sensible and responsible process, capital I, capital F, if we had a process like that, what would it look like?
It would look like a balanced state budget, which is required by the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That was operating essentially it was solvent. It's solvent,
yes.
I guess would be the word I'm looking for.
Yes.
Because what we see now is unfortunately a budget where there's a structural deficit built in.
Yes.
And that happened under the control of Governor Wolf and into the control of Governor Shapiro. And it is now a situation where if something isn't done to correct course, we're going to have to, in Pennsylvania, have to ultimately enact tax increases in the next few years, and very significant ones. A good working system would not create a crisis like that for each budget.
Right.
But now we're facing, because Governor Shapiro put into effect a budget that didn't address the structural deficit, we're now seeing the budget reserves being dwindled.
Governor wants to dip into the rainy day fund. And that's that's like the fail-safe. That's the emergency fund.
And there was the government was very flush with money because of the COVID epidemic a few years ago. There was a lot of money flowing to the states, including Pennsylvania, from Washington.
Mm-hmm. Hot off the printing press.
So they could kind of cover up some of these practices that were not favorable to consumers. But now the time has come where it's clear if we don't get that budget on track and stop reducing the spending, we're going to see a tax increase and the miseries that that's going to cause.
Yeah. And Rebecca, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I want to just sort of sketch this out. So the structural deficit means that mandatory spending is increasing faster than the receipts to the Treasury from the natural growth of the economy.
Right. It's essentially living on sort of one-time money over time. So sort of cobbling together pieces of money that aren't going to come back next year.
Yeah. They call it non-recurring revenue.
The world
that we should want to be solvent, to be stable, would be to have a dynamic where through the natural growth of the economy, that enough revenues are being generated for the Commonwealth to pay for all of our core services, including the mandatory spending, which is the social services programs. Like that's where we should be. That's where a healthy state That would be the sweet spot. That's where we would operate. You know, one of the dynamics that we have making things difficult is the Medicaid population. And again, Medicaid is a program that was intended for poor people, poor senior citizens, people with disabilities, and poor expectant mothers or mothers with small children. Like, that's what Medicaid was meant for. But under the Obama administration and Obamacare, that the federal government essentially bribed the states to enroll people who were not in those three categories. And so you now have able-bodied, working-age people with no dependents who are receiving these benefits. And in fact, that the federal government is funding a coverage for those people at a higher rate than the people for whom the program was intended. And like, that's a problem. And it's something that the Trump administration is focused on. And so that may also complicate our budget picture, because what Washington should do is to say, no, we're not funding these people who are ineligible. We're not funding illegal aliens. And so therefore, we're not going to send that money to the states.
Well, to give you an idea of what the scope of that specific problem is, 40% of the state's operating expenses is federal money. So that's about $50 billion. But of that, human services makes up 70 cents of every federal dollar. Wow. So that's this SNAP and Medicaid is what you're talking about. So mm-hmm. 70 cents of every federal dollar is those human services. And that's 40% of state operating expenses.
And it's completely unsustainable. Like, if we could just direct benefits to those American citizens who qualify to say that this is for poor senior citizens, that this is for people with disabilities, that this is for poor young mothers or expectant mothers, we could rationalize these expenditures and actually get the amount of money that's going out the door to be a controllable amount. But when you got the spigot all the way open and you're giving this money to people who are able-bodied, of working age with no dependents and no disability, and that you're also allowing benefits to flow to non-citizens, people who aren't even in the country legally, who never paid a dime into these programs, well, obviously there's no way to continue doing that. At some point, you're just going to go bust.
And part of it has an impact, too, on the workers who are available and willing to take jobs that are offered. You've done this, I know, and Rebecca, you've done this. You talk to business owners, and this has been this way now for years, and ask them what their biggest challenges are. Almost always they're going to say it's personnel. We can't find the people to fill these good jobs that we have. And in many cases, they are good jobs with excellent benefits, good hours, jobs that use your mind and your hands and whatever it may be. They can't get the people because many of them have realized that, hey, there's a gravy train here mm-hmm. connected with Medicaid, and even as an able-bodied citizen, they can use that as part of their ability to simply not reenter the workforce. It was never designed for that. It was always designed to be a temporary program that would help people get back on their feet, which we all can endorse, and those who were able would go back to work, and those who had a disability or small children or were aged, of course, wouldn't have to. But that's not what we've seen, sadly, and it's got repercussions.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation. And Steve, just taking that point one step further, that not only is it a fiscal reality that we can't afford to pay for idleness, but it's also a moral reality that this is not good for people. Like, human beings have agency and have talent and have potential. Human beings were never meant to be kept like house pets or zoo animals. People need the dignity and the sense of purpose and self-worth that comes from work. And so we're not doing anybody any favor to make them dependent, to keep them dependent, And, you know, especially when it comes to work requirements for these benefits, it is a necessary thing because the longer one is dormant, the more one's skills erode, the larger the gap then becomes in their credentials. Like, it would be good for people to even just go to a local charity and work for a couple hours a week, which is the only demand that's really in place for them. So it's not like you got to work 40 hours a week. It's just like, get up off the sofa and go do something useful.
Well, I mean, we talked on our last show about the incredible opportunity that the Nippon U.S. Steel deal is bringing to Pennsylvania. Clearly, we're going to have a lot of opportunity for trade jobs, manufacturing jobs, trucking jobs, transportation jobs. All of these things are going to be coming to Pennsylvania, and we need the workforce that's going to be able to sustain the economic development that we're going to have as a part of that deal, and hopefully as the economic activity that it's going to bring to the state. So maybe let's put some resources into job training programs and focusing on reorienting underprivileged folks who are taking advantage of these programs now into those job opportunities that we know we're going to have and employers are going to need them.
Absolutely, yes. The gravitational pull of market demand when we don't have enough workers, like, this should help to elevate wages, to motivate businesses to cast the net wider and to also to offer, I don't know what to say exactly, like wraparound services.
Yeah,
everybody's gonna have to level up. People on both sides of that equation, employers and new hires both. But we're gonna need employers to recognize that people who've been outside the workforce, that their financial condition is fragile. That maybe they don't have the social support that somebody else might have. That these are folks who are, you know, one car repair away from having their finances completely fall apart. But at the same time, for those new hires who really grab hold of the opportunity and show what they can do, that the employers who give them a hand up and bring them on board, those will be some of the most loyal employees that they will ever have, because they'll understand what was done for them and that there'll be a deep and abiding gratitude.
And you're absolutely right, David. And we've been talking about a lot of the negative sides of bad budgeting. At Commonwealth Foundation, we have put together a list of 10 of things that would make for a good Pennsylvania state budget as we move into this budget season and this budget negotiation process.
Yeah.
So just real briefly, number one, a good budget would reduce structural deficits to prevent Shapiro's tax hike, which essentially that would cause. A good budget would preserve the rainy day fund. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
A good budget would fund educational choice for needy students. There are students being left behind by our school system that need help right now. A good budget would enact Medicaid work requirements for healthy, childless, working age adults. We've talked about that extensively. Number five, a good budget would maintain scheduled tax reductions like the phase out of the CNIT, the corporate net income tax. A good budget would prioritize students over declining districts with excessive reserves. So money follows the child for education rather than propping up schools that are operating with empty rooms and antiquated conditions because they don't have the student population anymore. The seventh point would be that a good budget would extend regulatory relief to all Pennsylvanians. That unleashes our industry. It unleashes the potential we have. A good Pennsylvania budget would block energy tax hikes.
Yes.
Which would just be crushing, and with consumers still fighting off inflation and all the difficulties we've seen over the past few years, the last thing we should be doing is hike energy taxes, although the Shapiro administration has pushed for that at times. A good budget will adopt fiscal reforms to ensure a balanced budget, and a good budget will put mass transit reform before bailouts for failing mass transit systems.
Yeah, and in each one of these instances, and I couldn't possibly agree more, but in each one of these instances, it shows the kind of common sense and focus on results, don't tell me what your intention is. Show me how you're going to actually make it work. And if things are not working and are dysfunctional or are inadequate, how are you going to fix it? With the mass transit situation, you have you have entrenched bureaucracies, and that you have lots of feather bedding and other things where it's more expensive than it ought to be, and that, you know, if services need to be restructured or reduced, do it based on the patterns of current usage. Don't just, you know, what did they say, you know, shut down the Washington Monument to protest, a budget stalemate.
Like what people would have to do if they're in a retail situation or manufacturing situation. They can't just keep having a shortfall year after year. They've got to take steps. And as you said, these mass transit agencies, in particular SEPTA in the Southeast and the Allegheny County structure out there that they have for mass transportation, there's a lot of trouble there. There's practices that need to really stop, and there needs to be a reform that takes place if they're going to continue to have these taxpayer subsidized mass transit systems.
So, Rebecca, what are your concluding thoughts on all this?
I don't know. I will say I don't think we're going to have a non-time budget. That would be my first thought.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of issues here. We didn't really even get into some of the proposals the governor has, marijuana legalization for one, taxing games of skill is another. Those are some of the issues on the table, and those are not easy issues to come up with solutions for, and there is not wide agreement on them at all. So I think it's a difficult budget year. I'm sure we're going to end up with a sausage in the end, but that making that sausage is going to take a while, I think.
Well, anyway. You listeners know that we will be here every step of the way, so stay tuned. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this week's program. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and your group and the work that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org.
Wonderful. And Rebecca, where can people learn more about the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
They can find us at pmta.org.
Wonderful. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. A typical question asked by pollsters is whether the respondent thinks the nation is on the right track or on the wrong track. Rasmussen Reports has been asking the question for nearly 20 years, and for the first time since the inception of the poll, 50% of likely U.S. voters feel the country is headed in the right direction. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index rose by 12.3% in May, and the Present Situation Index, which is based on consumers' assessment of current business and labor market conditions, rose 4.8 points. The mid-May Consumer Price Index, or CPI, reported inflation fell to an annual rate of 2.3%. Recall it had peaked at over 9% during the Biden administration. Here in Penns Woods, there are both hopeful signs and storm clouds. The recent U.S. steel Nippon Steel deal, brokered by the Trump administration, is the most significant thing to happen to Pennsylvania's steel industry since the discovery of fire. A new state-of-the-art electric generating plant is slated to be built in Indiana County, and President Trump is promoting a resurgence in shipbuilding, which would benefit the Philadelphia region. But Pennsylvania has a history of snatching defeat from the jaws of economic victory. The state's energy industry has languished in the wake of former Governor Tom Wolf's embroiling the Commonwealth in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and Governor Josh Shapiro has continued to support the boondoggle. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, and U.S. News and World Report have recently released studies of economic competitiveness among the states and compiled rankings of the various components that together create the state's business climate. The 18th edition of the Rich States, Poor States, ALEC Laffer State Economic Competitive Index, co-authored by famed Reagan economist Dr. Arthur P. Laffer, policy expert Stephen Moore, and ALEC president and chief economist Jonathan Williams, concluded the report, quote, reinforces a clear trend. states that embrace limited government and free market principles continue to lead America's economic comeback. Pennsylvania is not one of those states, ranking 36th in overall economic performance. We were 50th, the worst in the nation, on labor policy, trailing right-to-work states, and 50th for our regressive estate and inheritance tax policies. Particularly impacting the state's economic competitiveness, Pennsylvania ranked 48th in the nation for our top marginal income tax rate. There were some bright spots. Pennsylvania ranked second in the nation for a lack of progressivity in personal income taxes. We have a flat rate. Fourth in the nation for a relatively low number of public employees per 1,000 population, and 11th in the nation for our sales tax burden. While the Rich States, Poor States report focuses on economic competitiveness, the U.S. News & World Report Best States rankings are more broad-based, taking into consideration factors such as crime, healthcare, and the natural environment. With a wider range of inputs, Pennsylvania fell even further down the list, with an overall ranking of 41, one being the best, 50 being the worst. The Commonwealth ranked 48th in education and healthcare categories, 36th for crime and corrections, and 30th for opportunity. The state's best ranking was a 19th place finish for our economy. A more focused report from the Tax Foundation on gas prices and transportation infrastructure also found Pennsylvania lagging. At 58.7 cents per gallon, the Commonwealth levies the third highest gas tax in the nation, but we rank 41st in the quality of our roads and bridges. When talking about economic competitiveness, Governor Josh Shapiro is fond of saying he is tired of getting beaten by Ohio. Ohio doesn't exactly win any prizes either, ranking 25th in the Rich States, Poor States analysis. Leading the nation in job and state GDP growth is the Beehive State, Utah, which has topped the ALEC ranking in each of its 18 years. Pennsylvania policymakers need to look to states like Utah, Tennessee, Indiana, and North Carolina, all of which have adopted tax and regulatory policies that create job opportunities and a great quality of life for their residents. While voters nationwide say America is on the right track, here in Penn's Woods, the Spring 2025 Keystone Business Climate Survey, conducted by the Lincoln Institute, found 41% of business owners and CEOs say the state's business climate has gotten worse over the past 6 months. Only 17% say they have gotten better. Tremendous opportunity lies ahead for Pennsylvania, but state policies, particularly those related to regulation and taxation, must change in a pro-growth direction and fast. Otherwise, while the rest of the nation enjoys the benefits of a growing economy, we will be left behind. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WVYC-FM in York, WEDO-AM in White Oak, along with WMCE-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.